Memorial Day will be celebrated this coming Monday, as you know. It was originally called Decoration Day, because shortly after the Civil War, people would go out to the various grave sites of the veterans that fought in the Civil War and decorate them with flowers and have other celebrations during that time. It began just shortly after the Civil War was concluded. In fact, just a few months in, I think, Charleston, South Carolina, where they first memorialized the veterans that had died in the war that claimed more lives of Americans than any other Civil War. I think it was nearly 600,000 altogether, which was a horrific loss. It was celebrated independently both in the North and the South, in Waterloo, New York, and also in Charleston, South Carolina at first. And then the tradition kind of spread to other communities. And eventually, somebody in some town everywhere across the United States at the time was celebrating a memorial to those fallen veterans of the Civil War. And then eventually, other wars and veterans were honored. And in 1971, it became an official federal holiday, Monday, the last Monday in the month of May. There is, although I didn't know this until I researched it, there is in every community a solemn observance at 3 p.m. local time on Memorial Day. I wonder how many people observe that time of silence. I don't know. But anyway, it's a nice thing. But Memorial Day, typically all the cemeteries are decorated with flowers and flags, and people honor the veterans that have died, the heroes of America. Other nations have similar holidays. Although some national holidays can lose their meaning with activities and barbecues and family gatherings, at least it seems as though this one has retained its true honorable meaning of honoring those that have fallen in war. And there is some reverence that is expressed on Memorial Day by, I think, most of the population, probably not perfect, and it's probably not broadcast enough or talked about enough in the news media as to what the true meaning is, but on Memorial Day, you can be certain that there will be reflections, there will be honors toward those who have sacrificed their courage, their devotion, there will be contemplation, and there will be remembrance of all those who have died. Interestingly, there will not be judgment of any of those individuals, right? There will not be any judgmental attitudes or reckoning of their imperfection while they lived. It is a really great day as a national holiday because it simply expresses appreciation for the ultimate sacrifice, giving of life. And there won't be any judgment toward any of those folks who have died. Instead, in a very healthy manner, the nation recognizes the honor and the sacrifice, period, the end. Nothing else. That is a great thing. Well, I believe that the Church of God should also memorialize its heroes and heroines, because the Bible does. We should remember their deeds, their exploits, both those mentioned in the Bible and those that aren't in the Bible, both past and present, because their examples should inspire us. My father didn't die in the war, but he served in the war. Douglas Rosalind Buchanan, born June 6, 1918, Greenock, Scotland, emigrated to this country when he was 3 years old, became an American. His parents became Americans. He fought for the 29th Division, which has its own special history, mostly a National Guard unit, but a whole division of men served in the 29th Division, and they were assigned to land on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. Just happened to be Dad's birthday, 26 years old. What a way to spend your birthday. His brother asked him number of years ago in our presence, whether they're both still alive, well, Douglas, How did you celebrate your 26th birthday again? Cowering in the sand, you know, dodging bullets. Apparently, Dad named me for one of his best friends in the 29th Division, a guy named Steve. I don't know who he was, but they were best of friends. And he didn't want to talk much about his war experiences, as many of our parents, some of you also had fathers who served in World War II, the Korean War, maybe even the Vietnam War. But we were able to, before he died, to extract enough information to help us to understand World War II better, to understand our family better. So today, I want you to take a moment to remember, to reflect, to meditate. We aren't perfect, and our heroes aren't perfect. Sometimes I think we expect too much, and we don't allow for human frailty or problems. But as I mentioned, on Memorial Day, all there will be is honor, memorial, reflection, thanksgiving even, of heroes who have died. And many will say they did not die in vain. I guess the point is, of all of this, that we're to learn the lessons of their lives. So can you find it in your heart, your mind, maybe to memorialize those in the faith that you have known? And we'll cover some of those that you have known. They're in the pages of the Bible. Even those who you knew were imperfect. I hope so, because we can all learn lessons from them, and that's our purpose today, to learn lessons from them, to honor them as a grateful nation honors and remembers its fallen soldiers. I hope I get through this message today. Some of it is personal, some of it is meditative, some of it is reflective, some of it's in the process of thinking about a lot of these things for an entire week, and you never know what's going to come out. You never know how it's going to come out in the final presentation. But I have some funny stories. Some of them I've shared through the years. Some are, I just think, funny examples that humanize the product, the individual that maybe we have seen on stage at the feast or heard about. Whatever. Some of these people are well known in the Church of God history, but I've saved all of those examples for the end because I don't know if I'm going to have enough time. But if I do have enough time, I would like to mention a few things. Some of them are funny. Some of them are courageous. Some of them are, well, just wait to see how many I can get to. If I don't get to any, then that's fine too. The sermon won't be incomplete because we'll be in the Bible. Those other personal examples are extra biblical, which I think are still fitting because they are people we have known in the faith and loved in the faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 32. Of course, the whole chapter is a memorial chapter. You get that, right? But Hebrews 11, 32 specifically hones in on, what, six individuals here, and I'm only going to concentrate on four, because they're in an easy-to-read book in one section of the Bible, in the section of the Bible called Judges, the book of the Bible called Judges. And the writer says in Hebrews 11, 32, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah." Of course, all those stories were recorded anyway, but the writer, I understand what he's saying. Time would fail. There's just not enough time to go through all of these great, wonderful stories to memorialize the individuals. They're already captured, so he doesn't need to. But I was kind of feeling like, am I going to really get through this sermon emotionally? Am I going to get through this sermon with the time limitations that we have? But time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel, so not going to cover those two, and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of aliens. Those descriptors at the end, as we go through the biblical examples today, I want you to remember how the Bible honors them, memorializes these individuals. And when you read through their examples that the writer has not taken time to just go over time and time again, he says, I don't have enough time. Just remember that the book of Judges captures one aspect of their lives, their imperfect lives at times, but maybe not everything. The writer of Hebrews adds on that these people were valiant, they were motivated by the Spirit of God, they were converted, God used them as his tools in a magnificent way. Don't forget that. Don't overlook weakness, of course, but don't overlook the fact that God did so many wonderful things through all of these individuals. So I've got a lot of stories too, but time is going to fail me. I've got this timer. We'll be able to cut this off at the right time. Every year at the General Conference of Elders meeting, we have a memorial to the elders and wives who have died in the faith in the past year. The last couple of years, I have not gotten through that. It's a good thing we're not there in person. The last couple of years, I have not gotten through that presentation without walking through the house, because we're watching it on Zoom or whatever, we're watching on YouTube or however they're presenting it to us. We're watching it live, but as I'm watching this memorial to friends and wives, friends who are ministers and their wives, I cry. And this year, Greg Thomas, who has been tasked with this job every year since we started this tradition many years ago, does such an outstanding job. He's the pastor in Cleveland, by the way. He has done such an outstanding job that this year I called him up because Mrs. LaRavia was so honored this year. And because she had died in the interim, she had died after the preparation had been done for last year's General Conference of Elders, but she was mentioned kind of partially, and then they decided that they would honor her. And, you know, when he got finished, man, I was bawling like a little baby. But I called him the next day and I said, Greg, that was such an unbelievable presentation. And then I started crying again. I just couldn't help it. He says, he let me cry. He let me have my cry, okay? But then he said, Steve, he says, you cannot imagine the emotional toll that this takes on me to prepare this, because I get this history and information from the ministers and friends and members of the elders and the wives, and then I go through from birth to death vicariously with them. And then I realized, wow, how are you keeping it together? I guess a lot of Kleenex. Oh. So anyway, Greg does such an incredible job with that, and Next week, since I had the brilliance to schedule myself for a sermonette here and a sermon in Sierra Vista, I decided I can't do both. So I'll take the sermon in Sierra Vista, and for the sermonette next week in both places, we will play Greg's memorial. So you'll see what I mean. We'll do that from the General Conference of Elders. So you can understand, we'll do that during the sermonette time. And those of you down in Sierra Vista, you don't have to set up the way you normally do for a broadcast. I'll just play it on my iPad and you'll get the same effect. Greg's recognition and memorial to our ministers and wives is so thoughtfully prepared. You kind of better cry, or you're not really human. You know, just so our Hall of Faith in the Church of God is rich, it is varied, it is expansive, and it's also imperfect, just as the list in Hebrews 11 has people who have imperfections. As the writer of Hebrews said, I don't have enough time to go through every significant example with you today, but I'd like to share with you maybe at the end some personal examples, along with these biblical examples from the book of Judges that highlight the exploits of God's people. Daniel mentions, let's just jot this down, okay? Daniel 11, verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. I believe that applies to those individuals in the book of Judges. And I also believe it has happened to us in our history, past, present, and in our future. Looking forward, it's certainly going to happen. Now, if you'll turn to the book of Judges, it mentions 12 specific individuals who ruled as judges over Israel. Well, kind of 13 in a way, and I'll tidy that up for you in a little bit. But there are five that overshadow the other eight. And let me explain. You know, I'm kind of a numbers guy. I'm not good at math necessarily, but I'm kind of a numbers guy, and I look for clues and numbers and that sort of thing. I combine Deborah and Barak as one individual or one group of judging. They were judging at the same time. I kind of keep them together. And they are mentioned in 55 verses in the book of Judges. Gideon is mentioned in 100. His story covers 100 verses in the book of Judges. The story of Jephthah covers 80 verses. So they're not mentioned every one, obviously. But Samson is mentioned in 90 verses. And it didn't strike me until I was preparing this message, but those are the four that are mentioned in Hebrews 11. Deborah's left out, but I don't know why, but it mentions her kind of in an oblique way, maybe, in other places. But these four are mentioned in the book of Hebrews. I didn't realize that, really. I mean, I hadn't thought about it, and I didn't realize it until the sermon was kind of coming together. You contrast that, if you'll turn to chapter 3 of Judges, chapter 3 and verse 31, this guy, Shamgar, was a judge who ruled and judged in Israel during the time of the judges. And it just says, after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad, with a piece of wood. And he also delivered Israel one time. That's his story. That's all we know about him, but he was apparently a righteous judge, but he's only mentioned once. There are a couple of people that are mentioned, two or three verses, but all of these individuals, kind of their history, and there's more to deal with here, so we can kind of make a sermon about these four and talk about them. The biblical examples of the judges are, I think, fascinating case studies of leadership. These individuals were governors in Israel. They were military leaders. They had executive and legislative power as well as judicial power. And most importantly, they were all divinely appointed by God to serve in that position during a very difficult time of 350, 400 years. Some of the time periods overlap, I'm sure, with the judges. So it's a long period of time, longer than our nation has been around, but that was and chapters 1 and 2 kind of give a summation of what happened as Israel enters into the promised land and then they fail. And you go through this cycle of people forgetting God, sinning, God allowing their enemies to overcome them, and then people finally cry for God to intervene, and he sends a judge every time. But there's that cycle that just continues on through. It's like history repeats itself over and over and over again, generation after generation. And as you read the book, you think, why didn't they learn? Why don't we learn? I don't know. Why didn't they learn? Well, chapter 2 is a summation of the history of this period of time of the judges. A good beginning for your own personal study in reading the book of Judges is just simply reading the book of Judges. Just read it. You know, because it's a story flow all the way through. That's a good beginning point if you're interested in studying this. Just read it. Just read the stories. But when you read the stories, you kind of be challenged by some things that you read. Not only is it a difficult time of the history of Israel, but it's a bloody time. It's a time of war. That makes it difficult. And there are also a lot of things that come up during this time that leave you shaking your head and wondering, why did they do this? Why did he do that? How could they be the people of God and allow this to happen? Why couldn't they have learned the lesson from just the generation before, et cetera, et cetera? You'll be stunned to see this thing, and you'll say, really? That happened? Because, well, that's how I reacted. I've always reacted in reading the book. You'll have some questions. It's a book of war and peace and rest and oppression, pioneering, even depravity. Sometimes there'll be, you know, rejoicing and looking to God. Other times it'll be like Sodom and Gomorrah. It is like Sodom and Gomorrah. You read through it. So you're going to have a lot of questions, but the end of the book, chapter 21 and verse 25, sums up the book in general. And it's also repeated in chapter 17 and verse 6. The same verse kind of gives you a flavor for, okay, this is what is happening. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Was that what was right always in God's eyes too? No. Sometimes it was, and you'll see that. You'll see that sometimes people acted in accordance with God's commands. But as a nation, because they had failed, and the chapter 1 shows that they failed miserably in driving out the people, this is what you get. This was the problem that you have. Now, this verse has been interpreted several ways. Some people have looked at it in a positive way. Well, every man did what was right in his own eyes. So they obeyed God. They had freedom. They had the ability to choose and to work and do this and that. But when you analyze the entire history of the book, you realize that's not really the case. They weren't really fearful of God or obedient to God the whole time. Sometimes they were when God would deliver them. But basically, the book shows failure without God. You neglect God, you disobey God, you follow other gods, you're going to have failure. I guess that's a great lesson in and of itself. One of the lessons I draw from reading the book of Judges is that the Christian life is tough. This is not speaking about Christians, because Christ hadn't appeared on the scene, obviously, but we're talking about people, some of them godly, some of them not, many of them not. But for a Christian, life can be tough, because you're surrounded, as Israel was, by sin. You're surrounded by temptation and problems. There were evil and pagan people all around them. And in a world like we live today, being a Christian is a tough proposition, because you're always faced with sin, depravity, problems, compromise, temptation, etc., etc. Now, why the author chose in Hebrews to highlight Gideon first, I don't know. But let's go to that example. Let's cover them an example, as the author of Hebrews does, and cover these individuals. And Gideon is found in Judges chapter 6. One of the lessons I draw from this is that sometimes God calls people who are really not confident that they can accomplish the task. Why me? Many people have said, reflecting on their own spiritual calling, even in the church of God. And this is the case with Gideon, who really didn't see himself as a great leader, but God did. Sometimes people rise to the occasion. That's what my dad taught me I don't even know if he's trying to teach me that lesson about World War II, but times of crisis sometimes help people elevate their game. Now, this did happen with Gideon, but it also happened primarily because God was with him. In verse 11 of Judges 6, it says, "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat underneath the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites." Now, the Midianites were a mean bunch, and they were massive in scale. So when you read the response that Gideon has, remember what it says in the earlier part of the chapter where we read in verse 3, "So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. Also Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them, and they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. And they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it." So thousands, hundreds of thousands of people would come and take what Israel had. This seemed to be a regular occurrence. Verse 12, "The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" A very positive statement about somebody that really didn't see himself in that way. "Gideon said to him, 'Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about?'" So he had had some good upbringing. You see a cycle in the book of Judges of forgetfulness, not knowing God. But in this case, at least generationally, he had been taught the truth. This Gideon had been taught the truth. "But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites.' Then the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours. From the hand of the Midianites have I not sent you?' And he said to him, 'O Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house.' And the Lord said to him, 'Surely I will be with you, as you shall defeat the Midianites as one man.' And then he said to him, 'If I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talks with me. Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out an offering and set it before you.' And he said, 'I'll wait until you come back.'" But God's very patient, allowed the angel to hang around for a while. "So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot. And he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. The angel of the God said to him, 'Take the meat and the unleavened bread, lay them on this rock, and pour out the broth.' And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, touched the meat, the unleavened bread, and the fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight." It is a magnificent story of God intervening to give confidence to somebody that didn't really have confidence. And he tells him in verse 23, "Peace be with you, do not fear, you shall not die." So despite whatever's going to happen, you're not going to die. That was an incredible promise. Now, later on in this chapter, you can read through it. He goes into the town with a bunch of his friends and tears down a statue to Baal. It was his father's statue. And he was kind of fearful of doing it because this is what people were worshiping. This is what people had put their faith in. This is what the people of Israel had become. His father had a statue. And it appears as though Gideon had some influence with his father as you read the rest of the story. Because after he tears this down, all the townspeople come to his father and say, "You know, look, you need to rebuke your son. You need to do something to him." And his father says, "You know, he tore down a statue of Baal. Let Baal take care of it." You know, that's, he said, "So I'm going to name you Zerubbabel. That's what I'm going to do, because that means let Baal fight him. You know, we don't have to buy, if Baal's so great, let Baal fight him. You know, let Baal take care of him." So going through the rest of the story here, we find it in chapter 8. We find the miracle of the fleece. God intervenes. The fleece is wet. The fleece is dry. Okay, you know the story. It's not a lack of faith. It's asking God to continue to give him the confidence. Sometimes the story has been, I think, misappropriated as, well, why did he have to do it two ways, both ways? Come on. It's natural. Doubting his own abilities, wanting God to be with him every step of the way, he was communicating with God the whole time, which was great. Now, in chapter 8, the men of Ephraim got upset, as sometimes the English can do, as we know, with the Manassites. That never changes, does it, through history? Verse 1, now the man of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. And so he said, what I have done now in comparison to you, it's not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Now look, what you've done so much better. You've had these kings delivered into your hands. He was a diplomat, and he kept the peace. That's a good thing. He wasn't perfect, though. We find that got all these earrings from all of these people that helped. They all chipped in these golden earrings, put them in, and he made a priestly garment, an ephod, out of them. You know, in verse 22, they all wanted to appoint him a king, and he said, the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for they have delivered us from the hand of the Midian. So there's great victory. And his response was perfect. I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. That was a great answer. But he obviously had some mistakes and problems along the way. He may not have cast himself or wanted himself to be cast as a king at this reading. But then he named one of his sons Abimelech. Abimelech means son of the king. So maybe his son took on some of those same, maybe there was something that was not quite so good about Gideon. We're talking over a period of time here. He was imperfect, but God used him. And he is mentioned in Hebrews 11, which I think is very encouraging. The next one that is mentioned is Barak. He's mentioned in Hebrews, Judges 4 and 5, get back a few pages, shows us another significant individual who is an important part of the story as well was Deborah. She is shown as a prophetess. And we'll read of the introduction to these two, quite a very interesting introduction. Chapter 4 and verse 1, when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Verse 3, now the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. This is well over 3,000 years ago, what the archaeologists call the Iron Age. I think the Iron Age was followed by the Bronze Age. But this is when men, what didn't just begin here, obviously, because they had developed iron chariots, which I have to imagine these iron chariots were pretty heavy. You've got cast iron pans. They're a lot heavier than regular pans, right? These iron chariots had to be formidable. They had to be heavy, but I would guess that they're kind of hard to drive. You must have had a lot of horses to have to drive a chariot of iron. Maybe they weren't all iron, but the iron is a heavy metal. And they had been able to perfect it. They had 900 chariots of iron, which meant that they could overwhelm a battlefield. So in verse 4 it says, now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lepidoth, was judging Israel at that time. So she was a judge as well. And she would sit underneath the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Why did they come to her for judgment? Because they knew that she was close to God, and they knew that God was with her, and that they knew that her decisions were wise. and they sought her counsel, even though a lot of other societies would never have allowed that. This shows us something. The culture and the people of Israel, as governed by the law of God, were different than all the other nations who basically regarded women as property or chattel. Not so in Israel. Women had rights. Women were individuals. Now, it was still a patriarchal society for the most part, but women had rights and opportunities in the nation of Israel, even during this period of time of the judges, that other nations did not have and would not adopt for thousands of years, and maybe still some have not adopted. Deborah had authority, and in verse 6, she sent for Barak, and he came to her, which shows that he understood. And she told him, basically, not she, but God, communicating through her, told him what to do. She sent, verse 6, and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded? Go and deploy the troops at Mount Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun, and against you I will deploy Sisera." She wasn't the one giving the orders. God was giving the orders, which I think sometimes even Bible scholars get mixed up on. God was giving orders through this woman, and he obeyed God. And he had a very close relationship, apparently, with Deborah. "Against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver you him into your hand." And Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you'll not go with me, I'm not going to go." And in some cases, that has been characterized as a weakness on his part. Oh, he's not going to go. She's not. He's too timid. He's too afraid. No. This was an acknowledgement that he recognized this woman as a prophetess. You know what? If you're going into battle, you want somebody that you know God is on their side with you, whether it's man or woman. And that's the way to look at this. Not like this guy was some weakling and he was timid and this woman was domineering him or ruling over him. No, 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 no. Wrong conclusion. And some have come to that wrong conclusion. This woman was esteemed in Israel, and there's nothing wrong with that. She was a prophetess. And he was brave as well. So in chapter 5, again, we don't have time to go through the entire. The chapter 5 is a song of victory sung by these two individuals. And note verse 28. Note what they sang about the death of this pagan leader. And you know that he was had a tent peg hammered into his skull and a woman killed him. No big deal, no problem. She was gallant, and what she did, she tricked him, and this guy was vicious. This guy was mean as a snake and ugly as a burnt rope. Well, I don't know if he was ugly as a burnt rope, but that's a famous saying by my father-in-law. Mean as a snake and ugly as a burnt rope. He was a bad dude. He deserved to die for all that he had done. Note what they sing about him. "The mother of Sisera looked through the window and cried out through the lattice, 'Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots?' Her wisest ladies answered her, 'Yes,' she answered herself, 'Are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two?'" You see, that's what these nations were. They take slaves. You know, every man, here's two women for you. Take them. They're your booty. You take them home. They're yours now. These were despicable people, these pagans. They needed to be gotten rid of. And it's a beautiful song all the way through verse 30. "For Sisera, plunderer of dyed garments, plunderer of garments embroidered and dyed, two dyed pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looter. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength." So, you read the rest of the story, but make no doubt about it. This was a brave man, a brave leader. God was able to help him work together with the other highly esteemed person in the nation of Israel, Deborah, who was a real gift. They were gifts to each other. And he was a great commander of the forces that he assembled. Now, the next individual, you have to ask yourself the question, what is the purpose of Samson? And do you really understand the magnificence of this individual, Samson? Now, some commentators portray him as an absolute giant. But we're given no indication that Samson was a giant. In some movies that I've watched, Samson is hulking above everybody else. He's like so huge. There's nothing in the Bible story to suggest that Samson was any bigger than anybody else. Probably, I would just guess, and I'm just going to guess right now, out loud, probably just of average size. Maybe pretty cut. Maybe pretty built out, and long hair, of course, since he had was under a Nazarite vow. But the reality of Samson gets lost in this romanticized, and by romanticized, I don't mean it's a good romance, but romanticized and novelized in the story of Samson and Delilah. And that's all people walk away with without understanding, really, the story of Samson and the lessons to draw from his life. So most accounts miss the lessons that I believe are very valuable. Now, unlike the rest of the judges, it doesn't appear that Samson has a lot of redeeming qualities, except God was working with him. It doesn't appear that he has a lot of redeeming qualities. But let's take a look at Judges 13. Because when you examine the vow of a Nazarite, it's captured in Numbers 6, it was a vow of dedication where the individual would separate himself to serve God for a period of time in the sense that they wouldn't have any alcohol and that they obviously would abstain from unclean foods and that their hair would not be cut as a sign of submission. But it was temporary. This was to be a lifelong vow of a Nazarite from birth. And his parents were announced this information by an angel who came to them and told them, you know, you're not going to be barren any longer. You're going to have this son, and his birth was announced. So there's got to be a purpose here for him. So, again, I mentioned number 6 explains the Nazarite vow. You can read that for yourself. But let's take a look at a few passages. First, chapter 13 and verse 25. The Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Menahath Dan between Zorah and Eshtal. God was working with Samson in a very powerful way. Also, we might come back to one or two of these. 14 and verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart. Now we'll get back to that in just a second. In verse 19, it says, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. And in chapter 15 and verse 14, when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. Now, God's Spirit was working with this man, and it appears as though, just not like something that overcomes you. I'm making the assumption now broadly that the Spirit of God works with an individual, and these were times where God was using Samson to accomplish his purpose, and it appears as though Samson was aligned with God during these particular times, doing righteous things or being protected by God. I'm just going to make the assumption that the Spirit of God was working with him as it works with us, not in this supernatural way. But think about with us. We don't have this supernatural strength. But I wonder, have you ever really thought about all that he accomplished with this supernatural strength, this unbelievable strength that he had? I mean, it's been kind of, I guess the word is romanticized in some ways, but can you even begin to comprehend the physicality of somebody that God has determined you're going to have extra supernatural power and strength by my Spirit. Have you ever really wondered about this? Think about what he did. When I think of Samson, I'm going to cite 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 24, where it says, "Some man's sins go on before, and some men's sins are hidden." To me, what you see with Samson is what you get. It's all out in the open. He's not hiding anything. He has very lustful appetites, especially when it concerns Philistine women and prostitutes. And that obviously separated him from God's purpose and was the reason eventually for his downfall. So he had a real weakness with Philistine women for sure. But in chapter 14 and verse 4, we see that his first choice of a Philistine wife was God's plan. His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. Well, eventually that first wife and her father got burned alive by the Philistines. We're talking about bloodthirsty tribes and people that would just put people in a home and set it on fire and watch them burn to death. I mean, how hideous is that? The Philistines at this time were a coastal people. They had been there for quite some time on the coast of the nation that we now know as the nation of Israel. But they had moved in there probably from someplace in the Mediterranean, maybe Crete, maybe. But they were highly organized. They were more efficient and organized than the tribal nature of Israel. They were militaristic. And they were encroaching bit by bit further and further into the territory of Israel. And as militaristic as they were, I have to think in reading the story of Samson that at least he did something to kind of stall their work forward into overtaking that land. So without God, I mean, they would have taken it over. There's no doubt about it because he kept moving further, further, and further. Finally, David defeated them, made them irrelevant later on. But consider the strength of Samson, chapter 14 and verse 6. "The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat." I mean, a baby goat. Not that you really want to tear apart a goat. Nobody really wants to do that, but like a tiny animal. Can you comprehend that strength? I mean, I think in this physical specimen, there's nobody else, especially in the history of mankind, that doesn't appear to be in the Bible, that had this kind of combination of brilliance, because he was quite witty. He has a riddle at his wedding, and he's kind of a smart guy, too. You read through his story. It's not just brawn here we're talking about. Can you imagine somebody, you've seen lions, what do they weigh, 400-500 pounds? How do you do that? With God's Spirit, I guess. Tore him apart. And then it shows in chapter 12, he's a clever guy as well. He's got a lot of smarts. This riddle at his wedding, kind of interesting. It also shows his weakness because his wife is able to get the secret out of him and she got money for it and et cetera, et cetera. So he had definitely these weaknesses which were pretty significant. But he kills a lion and he didn't even tell his parents about it. And then later on he sees the carcass, there's honey in it, he breaks his Nazirite vow. Doesn't seem to be such a big deal in the overall scheme of things. In verse 19, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, gave the changes of clothing." 30 people he killed. I'm guessing that these guys are coming after him with spears and ropes and knives and swords, but he kills them all and fulfills his part of the bargain here. And then there's other sad things. We're not going to go through there. You can read that for yourself. In chapter 15, in verse 14, it shows that he's captured. The tribe of Judah captures him, gives him to the Philistines. But He breaks all these ropes, these strong ropes. And then the next thing is so stunning. In verse 15, he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Well, one of the commentaries I read this past week was, well, the jawbone of an ass can be a significant and formidable weapon. I'm thinking, what is this guy? What are you talking about? Talking about a piece of bone, you kill 1,000 people with it? 1,000 people, single-handedly, coming after you with all of their military accoutrement. All of the war. This is unbelievable. What a sight that must have been. This guy was a killing machine. It's unbelievable. So, but not only that, but you read the example of where he catches 300 foxes. You know, people ride horses to catch one fox. Teams of people hunting down one fox. Samson is like, no big deal. You talk about agile and fast. I don't believe, after reading this story again and afresh and thinking about it, I don't believe there's ever been anybody in the history of mankind that had the possession of such speed and strength as Samson. No, there just couldn't have been. Nobody can catch 300 foxes, tie their tails together, light torches, and then go destroy fields with them. I mean, 300! It's shockingly amazing when you think about it. So, what's the lesson? What are we to learn from Samson's everything? You know, he kills 3,000 people in his death. What are we to learn? He was imperfect. But he goes into prison after he, and I don't think it's just his hair being cut that he lost his strength. I think it's because of his relationship with this pagan woman, his departure from God for a while, his lust. God's spirit departed. It can't operate in an environment that is so detrimental to God's law. And so it was gone. But in prison, yeah, his hair grew back. But you know what else? I believe in prison, before he was trotted out to the amusement of the Philistine princes and people for this whatever banquet or whatever it was, I believe he had time to think and repent. His strength came back. God was with him. His physical strength was just the embodiment of God working with his Holy Spirit through him. And you can't do that unless you have a willing party that is willing to be subservient to God. I think that's a good lesson. I think it's good to remember Samson as one of our memorialized heroes of the Bible, because people can change. That doesn't happen a lot. Doesn't happen very often. I know that. I get it. But people aren't concrete forms, you know. They grow, they mature. A human being can repent and change. And I believe even at the time of his death, he was repentant. And God used him for that purpose and allowed it to happen. The last judge that is mentioned is Jephthah. There are a lot of great exploits here with Jephthah. In verse, his story is in chapter 16. Got to go back. I misread my notes here. Okay. Back in chapter 11. Pardon me. It covers a story. A lot of erroneous conclusions have been drawn about the life of Jephthah. So Judges 11, it says, Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begot Jephthah. His own brothers drove him out, said, you have no inheritance with us. And so he fled. And in verse 3, it says that he fled from his brothers, dwelt in the land of Tob, and worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him. This kind of sounds like, and I've heard it explained as, you know, Jephthah, he got together with these evil guys, these worthless people, these individuals of no account, and here they were just raiding people. Nope. It's not the story. There are other erroneous conclusions that people have drawn about the life of Jephthah. Jephthah was thrown out of any possible inheritance with his family because he was illegitimate. He got together with a bunch of other people who also had no means, no money, no nothing. And they got together and they raided the pagan peoples of the land, trying to do something in submission to the commandment that had originally been given to the entire nation. Finally, they call him back in. They say, this guy's great. This guy's leader. And, you know, okay, I'll do that. And there's another part of the story that is probably the most troubling aspect for many who are reading this story, because it seems like such an odd moral thing. And a lot of people equate this with, okay, that just shows how depraved the whole time of the judges were, because people didn't really have a moral sense here, didn't have a moral groundwork. And we read about that in verse 29 of Judges 11. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed through Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah to Gilead, he advanced toward the people of Ammon," or Ammon. "And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, 'If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hand, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering.'" And you know the rest of the story. When he came back victorious, his daughter comes prancing out of the house, dancing, and, you know, she's got the cymbals going, and she's happy for her dad that daddy's been victorious. And, oh, no, now I've got to offer my own daughter up as a crispy critter, burn her alive. And I've even had people in the church come to that conclusion. But did Jephthah offer his daughter up as a burnt sacrifice? The answer is unequivocally no. He did not. Even in this depraved time of Judges, let's take a little closer look at Jephthah. Take a look a little bit earlier in the chapter of 11. In verse 12, it says, "Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, saying, 'What have you got against me that you come and fight against me in my land?'" You know, what's the problem? What's the issue here between the people of Ammon and the people of Israel? "And the king of the people of Ammon answered the messengers of Jephthah, 'Because Israel took away my land when they come up out of Egypt from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok to the Jordan, etc., etc. And, you know, if you want peace now, you got to restore all these lands." Revisionist history isn't just something of a recent occurrence, we find in reading the rest of the chapter. So point by point, chapter and verse, very succinctly, the message goes back to the people of Ammon. That is not the way it happened. Here's how, and you can read it for yourself. And he gives them a little history lesson and says, no, this is what God gave us. And you did this. Your people did this. This happened hundreds of years ago, but no. You're wrong, and we're right. So they go to battle, and he is victorious. So first he set the record straight with these folks. And, you know, sometimes it's good to do that. Sometimes when people err and they are wrong and they have got it in their heads that they are wrong, maybe someday you can do this, you have to set the record straight. You may have to set the record straight and help them to understand their revisionist history is wrong. Sometimes in a personal way, sometimes in a public way, sometimes that has to be done. Look, the point is, Jephthah knew God's commands. For him to say that he would sacrifice anything that came out of the gate is ludicrous. He knew the law as well as any of the judges. He knew child sacrifice was forbidden. So, first, to understand this and realize that he didn't sacrifice his daughter as a human sacrifice, despite his what it seems like kind of a rash vow. But when you Hebrew is, my brother was telling me recently, he said, you know, Hebrew is a language, is like one of the worst languages, you know, because there's so many different things something can mean and whatever. I'm not sure if, Hugh, you're probably right. I don't know. But anyhow, sometimes the translations don't really help you unless you dig a little deeper. So this is where you have to ask yourself a question when you're reading the story of Judges. Did that really happen? Did he really sacrifice his daughter in disobedience to God's laws when he knew better just because he felt like he had to fulfill his oath? No. Notice the condition of the vow in verse 31. Whatever comes out to meet me is actually better rendered as the one who comes forth to meet me. So it's an individual, not whatever comes out, the one who comes out to meet me. And the Nelson Bible Study says the phrase to meet me seems to refer more appropriately to a human than to an animal. The next part of the phrase is probably better translated, shall surely be the Lord's, or I will offer a burnt offering. So it was a whatever comes out the door, whoever comes out the door to greet me, or I will offer a burnt sacrifice. So this is the condition. It's not whatever or whoever came out of the door shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. That's not the way it was. It's rather whatever comes outside of the door will be dedicated to God. In this case, we find out at the end of the chapter, when Jephthah tells his daughter, you know, I have vowed you to the Lord. She doesn't say, no, you're not going to kill me, are you? You're not going to roast me somehow. No, she's just says, you know, Daddy, verse 36, whatever you've given the word to your Lord, you've got to do it. And so in this case, she was a person that was dedicated to God. Now, if it had been an animal, the clean animal that came out of the door, that would have been offered as a sacrifice to God. You've given your word to the Lord, so do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the people of Ammon. Then she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months that I may go wander the mountains, bewail my virginity and my friends and I. And so he said, go. And so she, verse 38, she bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And so it was at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. And then it says she wasn't roasted at the stake or put on the fire of as a sacrifice. It says she knew no man. So what did she do? To fulfill her vow, to fulfill his vow to God, she dedicated the rest of her life in service to God, probably helping the priesthood or whatever. In no way was she sacrificed as a human sacrifice. And so it was at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which she had known. She knew no man. And it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Maybe a rash vow to make, but not to the point of violating God's commands by fulfilling a vow. That is not what happened here. Although I think some people think that did happen here, but it didn't. These are individuals are mentioned in the book of Hebrews as four fallen comrades to memorialize. Overall, God works through imperfect human instruments. We have known men and women in the faith like these, who have been imperfect, because we all are. But perhaps these examples show us that you can't wipe out the entire body of work where somebody's been serving God because of one mistake or one frailty or human error. because there are flaws in all of us. So when you read through the book of Judges, ask some tough questions, but remember the examples of godliness, most of all in your memorializing of the people of faith.